of how are they spending all of the excess money that goes outside of the costs associated with trying to stamp out smoking, which now we know they may have reason not to do. You, of course, can't answer that question because they don't account for that. There's no sense of like, well, here's how we spent this in tax money we collected.
It's difficult to do that. The government certainly doesn't publish those figures. And of course, some is split provincially and some of it goes federally. I think, though, that the more interesting fact, the point about that is looking at, okay, the government is taking upwards of 80% of the sale. Who's actually controlling this business? Who really is to big tobacco in these days? Well, clearly you have your large tobacco companies, whether they be Philip Morris, Japan Tobacco International, British American Tobacco, and a host of other smaller but very profitable companies as well. Okay, they're the trademark owners. They are actually manufacturing the product. They're procuring the sale and distribution of the product. So very clearly, we do have a tobacco industry. But who's controlling that? And if you want to be a cynic and look at this from a different perspective, you could make a very, very good argument that actually the tobacco industry is the government because they are the main stakeholder in the business. And in more ways than just taking on those billions of dollars of taxation revenue and taking 80%. So you have a stakeholder that's taking 80% of the profits from a company. They're controlling that business. And I don't think too many people would say they're not controlling the business. But it's not just that. It goes further. They're also regulating what goes in the product. They're regulating how it's sold. In many countries, they're regulating the price. They're regulating who can and cannot smoke, where the product can be consumed, what age you have to be to buy it, how it's distributed, whether or not you can use the livery that and the branding on your product that you've built the value up over many years. Who's controlling this? And when you look at it, it's actually, you could make a very good claim and a very good case to say, actually, the big tobacco are the governments of the world.
Well, except that unprecedented level of control that the government exerts over this one industry is commonly thought of as a means for the destruction of that industry. That the point of this is to gradually phase out the industry itself. Are you suggesting they have no such intention?
Well, that's a great question. And I think you can, and it's very difficult to answer on either side because no one from in the industry is ever going to admit that. And no one from the inside the government, as far as I know, is ever going to.
Has any government done it? Has any government just simply outlawed cigarettes?
So there is one country in the world where tobacco sales are outlawed, and that is Bhutan. There are no other jurisdictions in the world, certainly at the moment, where tobacco is completely legal. What is interesting is the government of New Zealand recently brought some legislation to the table which wanted to gradually bring in a graduated no smoking age so that children born from 2024, 2025 onwards wouldn't be allowed to purchase cigarettes in the future. That legislation has been struck down, and there are many, potentially many constitutional legal problems with that kind of argument.
Why did you leave? It seems that you've made peace with, I'm not creating a space here to moralize or accuse anybody of hypocrisy. The point is, you were able to make your peace with working for Big Tobacco until you left. So why did you leave?
I had moments when I was there that did make me question the industry. At foremost, I was a lawyer. I am a lawyer, and I was defending an industry, and I believe everyone has the right to the due process of the law. So in itself, as a lawyer, I made peace with the business itself. I did have some hard days in my very junior days working in the domestic British and Irish business in London about 25 years ago. I had a couple of hard days when I was the lawyer advising the consumer services team. People used to write in to the company with various types of complaints about the product, whether it had been an exploding cigarette that had been in their pack, or they fell asleep in bed and burned themselves with the product.
An exploding cigarette?
Exploding cigarette, yeah.
What the hell is in cigarettes that can explode?
So some of the lower tar brands, in order to get the delivery of the tar and nicotine down below a certain level, you had to make rather than put in proper cured tobacco, you'd put something in called tobacco sheet, which was basically like tobacco popcorn. And that tobacco sheet that went into the product sometimes had air pockets in it. And it was not uncommon, although not in every pack, of course, but it was known to pop a little bit and cause a bit of a spark.
Not in every pack. It's sort of like the golden ticket in a Willy Wonka chocolate bar.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. Those products didn't taste very nice either, but in the 1990s and 2000s, there was a push for a healthier tobacco product, and it was deemed at that time that smoke a light cigarette and that it's better for you than smoking a full-flavor, full-tar nicotine cigarette. There's certainly no scientific proof behind that, and there's definitely no way of smoking, but that's the way it was going. Even in Canada, the drive by the government for many, many years was to force the tobacco industry to put the toxic constituents on the side of the pack and to lower those toxic constituents over a period of time in the hopes that people would smoke less and inhale less by having a lower tar and a lower nicotine product.
I'm not sure I actually got the answer to the question, why did you leave the industry?
I left the industry for a couple of reasons. I had done a number of years working as an expat, which, as we started by saying, you know, it was very financially beneficial. But they pay you that money for a reason, and they move you around. I was traveling consistently all of the time. Every week I was flying around somewhere. And my decision to leave the industry actually was based upon more about the lifestyle that I was leading rather than the business that I was working in. I'd love to sit here and tell you that I had a moral moment when I said, no, I must stop this. I can't do this anymore. That wasn't the moment. I did have some moments like that along the way, particularly when you're dealing with family and cancer and the tragedy that tobacco causes to pretty much every family worldwide. But I didn't leave because of that.
It wasn't the exploding cigarettes.
It wasn't the exploding cigarettes. To me,
there's a difference between coming to a moral place where you say, I cannot in good conscience do this anymore, is a different thing than saying, I'd rather not have to explain this to people all the time. It's a bit of a burden to have to apologize or explain or deal with people who call me names. Like, it's just, given the choice, I'd rather not.
It does wear thin very quickly. Mm-hmm. And I was traveling around the world very frequently. It was very tiring. I was not seeing my children growing up. There was one year I'd never even been to my children's school. I hadn't met their teachers. And my youngest daughter didn't even know who I was because I was away so much. And I said to myself, this has got to stop.
This is all fascinating. You left the industry and you say that you now provide legal advice for contentious industries. I guess tobacco is a contentious industry. What else is a contentious industry?
Cannabis, mushroom, psilocybin, online gaming, pharmaceutical, nutraceutical, adult products, those types of things.
Sin businesses.
Sin businesses, yeah. Mm-hmm. Helping companies with compliance and understanding that your product may be severely restricted, and those restrictions can bring, if you breach those restrictions, there can be significant consequences, whether those consequences are fines, whether they're lawsuits, whether they're some other kind of penalty.
So here you are, you've left big tobacco, but you have an area of expertise, which is extensive experience navigating a detested, hated, tightly, highly regulated industry as it discovers that despite that enmity and animosity and despite the government supposedly regulating it out of existence, it can become more profitable than ever. And you decide that you're going to take that know-how to every other industry that you can.
That's exactly what I've been trying to do, and with some success. I'd like to hope it's because of the work that I do and how the advice that I give to my clients. I think there's a bit of luck in there too.
Okay, this is where my conversation with Max Krangle about cigarettes ends, and where our conversation about guns, porn, and journalism begins. And that conversation deserves its own episode. And we will be bringing you that very soon. That's your Canada Land episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I can be emailed at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything that you send. Our website is canadaland.com. Come and sign up for our newsletter. You won't regret that decision. The senior producer of this episode is Bruce Thorson. Our audio editor is Tristan Capicchione. Our managing editor is Annette Ejofor. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Sandy Garasino, journalist with the National Observer. Welcome back to Shortcuts.
Nice to be here, Jesse. So nice to reconnect that long loss. It's been a long time.
It's been too long. Today on the show, what Mary Berg did. Welcome back to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news. Sandy, can you believe what Mary Berg did?
I can't believe what Mary Berg did. Tell me, Jesse, what did Mary Berg do?
I mean, I'm looking at these ads that have been all over Twitter and all over YouTube. I mean, they have been all over Twitter to the extent that she was a trending topic. Mary Berg's statement shocked everyone. Mary Berg's fatal mistake. Discover what happened next. And here she is sitting next to CTV anchor Omar Sashadina. What did she do? Here she is being like hauled off by a cop. Mary Berg, I'm ashamed of what I did. Mary Berg's career is over after her on-air remarks. This is like a global scandal, says this other one. And here she is again being like, this is like a different police officer. Was she arrested twice? What did Mary Berg do?
Mary.
Mary Berg. And for that matter, who is Mary Berg? Because I'd never heard of her before. Seeing my social media feeds filled with these images of her being hauled away by the cops. Well, here in Canada Land, Sandy, we are
Canada's most wanted. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, this is serious stuff. And we are, you know, this is our beat here. You know, if there's a Canadian media figure who is involved in scandal, we want to get to the bottom of it. So I have done a deep dive into what Mary Berg did. And Mary Berg, the winner of MasterChef Canada Season 6 and host of a number of shows. She's crossed over recently to the Food Network in the United States. Adorable, cute as a button, redheaded food personality, Mary Berg.
I'm going to eat a lot of soup today. Look at that gnocchi pile. Mary Berg, you learn something new in the kitchen every day.
From what I can tell, the worst thing that she's done is fill a croissant with ricotta and call it a cannoli, which, to be fair, is something you can get arrested for in Italy or France.
You know, that's she's skating pretty close to the edge there, I gotta say.
All right, what the hell are we talking about, and what the hell is going on here? I think a lot of people will be like, yeah, I saw those ads too, because this was everywhere. These are fake ads. Mary Berg is the latest victim of this trend in spamvertising where, I don't know, maybe this is happening in the States to American media personalities, but here we've seen Omar Sashadina, we've seen Amanda Lang. In fact, Amanda Lang is currently in a bunch of ads. Interview interrupted after 15 minutes. She revealed a state secret. Click through to find out. It may be the end of her career. We've talked about this before. And in fact, with Omar Sashadina, they actually created deep fake video of him selling some shady cannabis product. And the Mary Berg one just seems to be like more than we've ever seen before. And when you click through, and out of curiosity, my colleagues did click through, you find yourself on like some crypto, I'm going to call it a crypto scam site, because the very fact that you were misled to click on it is a level of fraud. I'm a little bit doubtful that it's a squeaky clean crypto product that's being offered on the other end, but haven't done that research. If you look at the about this advertiser stuff, it says advertiser has not verified their identity yet. Blake Babcock, location India. Very dubious. What do you make of this advertising format and its like recent dominance, Sandy?
Well, it's interesting because for whatever reason, I had not seen the Mary Berg ads, but I mentioned this to my husband and he goes, yeah, what's going on with that? I'm seeing that everywhere. So apparently, I don't know what I've done to my settings, but I'm not seeing those ads. But apparently it's true. They are blanketing social media. And the fact that, first of all, they are defamatory, they are a smear, they're dishonest in smearing Mary Berg. There are other examples of things like this. I noticed that NBC has reported that Google and Bing were putting non-consensual deepfake porn involving celebrities at the top of some of their search results. This was reported just the other day. And there are lawyers who are starting to really go after this kind of thing. I note that the social media site Omegle recently was sued basically into oblivion and has now collapsed and failed as a result of lawsuits. Lawsuits, especially in the United States, but generally by people like, if Mary Berg were going to sue, typically a lot of those lawsuits have tended to fail because of something called Section 230, which people in media know, but a lot of the public don't, which gives pretty much blanket immunity to social media sites for anything that appears on their websites. However, in this case, social media sites, whether it's YouTube or Twitter or any of these other sites that are actually monetizing this defamation, I think that there's potential real cause of action. And lawyers have started to really chip away at those protections. And a lot of this litigation is really getting going. So I think that this is a flag. If I were, say, Linda Yaccarino at Twitter, which I will call Twitter, or if I were in advertising sales at Google, YouTube, Instagram, and I was monetizing any of this kind of stuff, I would be flagging this because it's obviously bad. It's also dishonest. It's a scam. It's promoting fraud. It's defamatory, but it's also a danger if you are monetizing this, not just that you're hosting this content. Now you're actually making money from this content. And I think that there's a real legal risk here. And I sure hope that Mary Berg and people like her sue these platforms, take them for all they can get out of them, because this is really a nasty, nasty new low.
I wouldn't mind if Mary Berg sued Elon Musk for everything she could get for these. And I think that the fact that they're taking money, it's not simply the usual dumb pipe argument of like, hey, we're not responsible for what people post on Twitter.
Yeah.
Well, you're responsible for the messages that you have taken cash for and you have propagated them to the point where is this a top trending
topic?
And
you're promoting them.
That's right.
You're promoting them for money.
And, you know, one of the main things that came out of this is there's always been a lot of spam on Twitter. I'm wondering how cheap are ads on Twitter now that Musk has tanked it to the point where, you know, this is bottom of the barrel fraudulent advertising. And it's just absolutely glutting our feeds to the point where it was a trending topic, though I don't know how much credibility we can give that, because maybe buying ads on Twitter, you also buy yourself algorithmic favor on their trending topics. Who knows at this point? It's all a black box. But it did make me think like, wow, their advertising system is incredibly broken. But, you know, can't just blame Musk for that, because it's all over YouTube as well. I will split this hair. And, you know, I'll say this first. This is terrible for Mary Berg. Like, you know, I was having a bit of fun earlier because it's so ridiculous. And this bad Photoshop of her being let off by cops, I mean, it's so silly. But if you are the recipient of this, the experience must be terrible. Everybody's seeing these images and everybody asking, and I'm sure your relatives calling you and saying, what happened? And, you know, it's not a pleasant thing, and that's real. But Sandy, you are a lawyer. Is this defamatory?
Yes.
I mean, I know a little bit.
First of all, it's false, and it says you're being arrested. And it's being spread all over social media, which, by the way, these are the main sites that most eyeballs are going to. I mean, the average person is not like you, me, or our listeners, Jesse Brown. The average person is just out there, you know, coasting around on TikTok, YouTube, and they're seeing all this stuff, and they're not following Canada Land or any of the coverage. They're not seeing, they don't know anything. What they see of Mary Berg is that she's some kind of most wanted criminal in Canada. Yes, that's defamatory, in my opinion.
I have a curiosity and an interest in the limits of defamation. And I also am really curious about just clickbait. And it's interesting to me because I know that Canadians tend to be a lot more interested in American personalities. And I guess Mary Berg is starting to cross over into the Food Network. But it's interesting to me that these bits of social media content look very algorithmic to me. They look very, you know, and I know a bit about how clickbait works, and you try a bunch of stuff and you try different personalities and you see which ones, like, why Mary Berg? Why are they picking on Mary Berg? And some people here thought, like, this feels personal. Like, maybe somebody's got, like, a personal vendetta against her. Maybe this is some ex of hers or something. I don't think so. When I look at these, I see, I wouldn't be surprised if, like, a machine spat these out, like, tried out 20 different personalities and went through a bunch of different Photoshop images, and this was the one that people were most interested in for all of those weird, what makes a song a hit? What makes a clickbait ad a hit? Like, something about the way Mary Berg looks and her squeaky clean image and her very expressive face, and then juxtapose that with the cops leading her away. And then it seemed to me that the way these ads are constructed was very deliberately to skirt the edge of defamation, because it doesn't say anywhere that she's been arrested. It says, I'm ashamed of what I did, says Mary Berg, and her career is over. And then there's an image of her being led away. And, images, I'm not sure what the case history is.
No. It's very clear. The innuendo is very clear. An innuendo is part of defamation. You're showing someone being led away in handcuffs. That's especially when it's Photoshop and it's fraud. So this is a manufactured photograph to give the viewer the clear information that this person's been arrested.
I hope that you are right, and I hope that they get Blake Babcock of India. There's no Blake Babcock of India. This is all just fraud. No. You know what? I'm with you, Sandy. I think that this is going to be interesting because the advertiser here may not be findable. It might be like layer upon layer of scam. But the fact that both Google and Twitter took the money means that they might be on the hook. And it would be really interesting to follow this if Mary Berg does sue them, because, like, there is a traceable, findable, deep-pocketed party here who has been hurting her. Who has been hurting her by publishing these things and spreading them. So
I think the real question here, Jesse, is, and especially as we're starting to see the collapse of traditional media platforms and the rise and really the almost supremacy of the social media platforms and the online media platforms. And, you know, we kind of have emerged, we've entered a new era. We used to give all these platforms a pass. There was the immunity rendered by the American legislation, this Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which did grant pretty widespread immunity. That is being systematically chipped away. And you start to see people like Alex Jones being subject to massive, massive damage awards by the Sandy Hook parents. Omegle has been taken down. Lawyers are finding their way in to get past this veil of immunity, and they are going after the platforms themselves. And I think this is a perfect example. This and things like the deepfake porn, if it's not just sort of user-generated content, but it's actually monetized content that is making money for these platforms, that's, I think, they're in real trouble. And Godspeed, I've been talking about this for over 10 years now, for 12 years, I've been talking about getting after these platforms. And now as we're getting into the AI period, I think we're going to start to see some real responses. I pray and hope that we start to see some real responses.
The AI thing does make it interesting, and I would love to know exactly how these things are generated and if this was just robots on their own spinning through every variation and finding, you know, because you use data sets.
Most likely.
Somebody like Mary Berg, there's a lot of footage online. So that's, you know, and you probably run that against 20 other personalities and see which ones work. I want to hear from Mary Berg about this. And I think it's awful that this is kind of like, I can understand why she's just not talking about it. But we did reach out to her PR firm, and Bell Media got back in touch with us and said they're aware of the issue. They encourage social media users to remain vigilant against these deceptive ads and report suspicious content to the platform they're using. They didn't provide any additional comment. We'll do our part here on Canada Land when we see well-known Canadian media personalities shilling for really dubious, shady products. We will dig into it. And here's one last clip that I want to leave people with.
Peter, we have quite a few questions about retirement. Asking yourself the right questions leads to the right answers.
Were you truly ready to hang it all up?
Retirement's not an ending. It's an opportunity.
Care to elaborate?
You can find new purpose, passions, financial possibilities. It can be whatever you choose to make it.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
Ask yourself what the Chip Reverse Mortgage can do for you.
Sandy, people can't see that listening to the podcast, but that very weird, dubious-looking AI stuff happening. Peter Mansbridge is giving a press conference on these reverse mortgages where people can sell away equity in their own homes. And the audience who are grilling him, they're journalists who are asking him these tough questions. It's an audience of Peter Mansbridge's. It looks like an AI-generated audience of Peter Mansbridge. It looks very dubious and shady. Well, we've looked into this, and we can tell you those are legit. That is Peter Mansbridge shilling for a reverse mortgage product. In fact, Pastor Mansbridge has been hired by Chip Reverse Mortgages as they're calling him a consultant. You know, Kevin Newman came out and said, you know, Peter Mansbridge has given a lot of speeches about the dangers of fake news, and it's suggested that this is hypocritical of him to be using his credibility as a news personality, basically play-acting as a journalist asking tough questions. Doesn't help the fake news case. I got to say, I can't go with Kevin Newman on that, because, like, Mansbridge would have to... He'd have to have credibility to lose. And the very first scoop that Canada Land ever reported was Peter Mansbridge taking money from the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers, fairly secretly. Nobody knew about this, while he was covering the oil sands as the anchor of the Nationals. So don't hate the player, hate the game. Peter Mansbridge, in addition to his $500,000 a year pension from the CBC, which we know about also from Canada Land reporting, God knows how much he's getting for selling reverse mortgages to boomers.
I'm sorry, I'm going to push back on this a little bit.
Please,
Jesse.
That's why we want you here.
As important and seminal and influential as Canada Land is, I don't think that we have really taken down the reputation of, or you have taken down the reputation of Peter Mansbridge. I think he is still a beloved and respected and influential figure, and I'm just going to leave it there.
Sandy Garasino, it's great to have you back. Thank you. That is Shortcuts for this week.
Thanks very much, Jesse. Nice to be here again.
I can be emailed at jesse@canadaland.com, and I read everything that our listeners send in. Sandy Garasino, where can people find you?
Jesse, I'm not writing so much for the National Observer anymore, but I do have a project in the works that I'm hoping that people will be seeing in the next few weeks or couple months. So on the National Observer. So, but otherwise, people can find me on Twitter. And I do call it Twitter, @Garasino on Twitter.
Who would ever call it anything else?
That's right.
This episode is produced by Aviva Lassard with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our managing editor is Annette Ajofor. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Our theme music is by So-Called, syndications by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Starting from the week of Monday, May 30th, the Student Union Building is open 7 days a week from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. The sub-building common spaces, along with the bookable spaces, are available for use. Any comments or questions, please go to the Simon Fraser Student Society website at sfss.ca for more information.